Hi, Siobhan Sarna here with SIBO SOS. I hope you were able to join us for the Gut and Microbiome Rescue Summit. It just wrapped. 70,000 people came. Thank you so much for making it such a huge success in getting the information out to as many people as possible. If you missed it, we do have a free replay coming up this weekend, so check it out, including the 10 masterclasses. And if you have SIBO, be sure to listen to Dr. Pimentel and Dr. Allison Seebecker talk about it in relation to the microbiome and some research updates. Now, what happened earlier today was a great session with Karen Krishnan live in our Facebook group. He is the founder of Microbiome Labs and is the one who's responsible for getting Megaspore out into the world and is just a brilliant educator and person. And it's something I had planned months ago because I knew the summit was wrapping and I was so excited about it, but I had to do some unexpected traveling. So my husband and I are driving on the highway. We pull over to a place we think is for sure gonna have great internet there. We got there early. And let me just say, the whole thing fell apart. At some point, you could not hear me. You could not see me. And my phone number was blasted across the Facebook group. All right, things happen. Live TV trained me well. Anyway, it's not up to my professional standard. However, I still wanted you to get the information. So I ask for a lot of grace, and I hope you gather the information that you need to move yourself forward on your health journey from the inside out with your microbiome and the immune system, and some great questions at the end. Enjoy.
To give you an analogy where it's easier to understand that, imagine you're at a big outdoor music festival, right? It's in a confined area, but it's a massive area. And in that festival, there are 200,000 attendees. Now, among that 200,000 attendees, there may be four or five that are problematic, that could be harmful to the rest of the audience. They've got illicit substances, they've got bad intentions. You are the lone security guard in that sea of 200,000 people. And it's your job during the course of that event to protect the rest of the audience, right? How would you ever go about surveying that sea of 200,000 people as a lone security guard to identify any egregious players, especially when the egregious players look very similar to everyone else that's there, right? So the only way you could do that with any degree of effectiveness is if the other 199,995 people were mic'd in with you, with the walkie-talkie, and were your eyes and ears, where if any of them saw anything that was disruptive, they would radio into you and tell you to where the location is and get you to hone into that area. That's the only way you can do it. There's no way for you to just walk around that place looking randomly for things that may be harmful, right? So all of those people, the other 99.9% of people, would be your neighborhood watch. That's essentially what's happening with the immune system, where we don't have enough immune cells to actually survey all of the surface area that we have inside the body that can encounter a new pathogen. But every square millimeter of that surface area that can encounter a new pathogen is already covered with your commensal microbes, which means that when a new pathogen comes in, one of the key things that has to happen is the microbes, your commensal microbes in that local area, will sense a change in that ecosystem because something new has entered that doesn't normally fit in that region. And then they will signal to your immune system to come and address this issue, right? So they actually shoot off flares to try to recruit your immune cells to that site of action. Now, how fast that happens will determine how well your body does against a particular pathogen. Let's say that we're talking about a virus, right? Let's say a virus enters through your respiratory tract and it's concentrating in your upper respiratory tract. Maybe it's in the nasal passages. It's in the mucosa in that area. If you've got a really good, healthy microbiome, you've got a diverse, well-functioning microbiome, the moment that virus hits that area, microbes around that area will start signaling to your immune cells that, hey, something new is here, come check it out. Very quickly, your innate immune cells within hours, we're talking about maybe an hour or 2 hours, will show up at that area and start doing the work they do to try to control any sort of pathogen that's in that area. then they will start recruiting the adaptive immune cells that come in and learn specifically what's in that area so that you can be protected next time you should encounter it, right? So all of that can happen within hours, and you basically end up in a situation where you don't even know you got exposed to something. You have no real symptoms. It's basically taken care of. That's what tends to happen most of the time, because we're all encountering pathogens all the time. Now, let's say your microbiome is compromised and you don't have that assistance, you don't have that neighborhood watch quality, then when something enters into your nasal passages, it can sit in that mucosal area and start invading cells and multiplying and increasing its numbers before the immune system ever notices it, right? So then, because its numbers are now much higher, the immune system freaks out and then attacks it with all kinds of inflammatory responses. That's when you start to feel sick. So that's when the fever starts setting in, the inflammation, the runny nose, all of that stuff, all the body aches. That's when all of that sets in, is when your immune system is going gangbusters trying to control this thing that's now spiraling out of control. Because you know, when you look at something like a virus, for example, when it invades one cell, it hijacks that cell's machinery so that that cell makes more copies of itself, of the virus. So one infected cell can make hundreds of new viruses, and as it bursts open. And then all of those new viruses will go and infect new cells. Each of them will make 100 more. So you could see how quickly the virus can multiply in your system if it's not being checked and if the immune system is not being recruited immediately to the area. Right? So that's a really important facet of how the microbiome controls immune response. Now, here's a really critical component of this. The way the microbiome signals to the immune system when something is off, when something needs attention, is it uses certain types of inflammatory markers, right? It can trigger the release or themselves directly release inflammatory markers that get the attention of the immune system. And then the immune system hone in on that inflammatory marker like a fire alarm, right? So imagine the microbiome sees a fire, it sounds a fire alarm, and the immune system is like the fireman on the fire truck. They show up and then they start putting out the fire. Now, here's where a big problem occurs. And we see this right now with the pandemic that's going on. If your body is under a constant state of low-grade inflammation, that low-grade inflammation happens to be the same kind of fire alarms that the microbiome would use to signal your immune system. If those signals are going on all over your body, then the signal that your microbiome is trying to give to your immune system ends up getting lost in that systemic alarm that's going on, right? So the immune system doesn't know where to focus. And so if the whole system is quiet and there's one loud alarm, the immune system knows where to go. If the whole system has a whole bunch of alarms all over the place all the time because of chronic low-grade inflammation, then the immune system does not know how to detect that important alarm of a new invading pathogen coming in. So the signals from the microbiome get drowned out if you have a state that is dictated by chronic low-grade inflammation. That's why in the case of COVID, for example, people that have the worst go of it are people who are diabetic, people who have cardiovascular disease, people who have hypertension, who are obese, people who are elder, because all of those things confer a certain degree of chronic low-grade inflammation. All of those conditions and parameters are associated with this chronic low-grade inflammation. So having this constant inflammatory state in your body allows the virus to enter, allows the virus to multiply and replicate at really high rates without the immune system being signaled to get there, and then allowing the virus to get to such a high level that when the immune system finally notices it, it has to throw everything at it. And then you start going into this world of the cytokine storm, because now the immune response is so robust and so profound that's when you start to feel really sick, and that's where all the symptoms come in, and then it pushes this risk of tumbling into the cytokine storm, right? So what is one of the major causes and drivers of this chronic low-grade inflammation? It's gut dysbiosis. So leaky gut, all of those conditions that we talked about, cardiovascular disease, diabetes, hypertension, all of these things are also associated with intestinal permeability and the low-grade inflammation that's driven by there. So again, a dysfunctional gut is already going to make you compromise, because a dysfunctional gut has basically indicates a dysfunctional microbiome throughout your body. That means that you're not training your immune cells well. You're not maturing them properly like you're supposed to. It also means that your microbiome is not acting like the neighborhood watch like it's supposed to. But even the components that are acting like a neighborhood watch, those signals are getting drowned out because you've got all of this inflammation throughout the rest of your body already, right? So that is the summation of why the microbiome is so critical to immune response. And if you're going to be focusing on improving your immune response and having more resilience when it comes to your immune response, addressing the microbiome becomes so important. And as I mentioned this before, I'll mention again, because I cannot overstate it, is no amount of any of those micronutrients, as important and powerful as they are for your immune response, they cannot overcome a dysfunctional microbiome, right? So you have to have a good, healthy, functional microbiome along with taking the other supplements that people typically take. Make sense?
Hi, Karan. Clarissa from the team here. I think we may have lost Siobhan.
Oh.
Yeah. So would you like to carry on with the next phase, or would you prefer to jump on to the questions? I don't want to cut your trajectory off.
Yeah, no worries. I think that's the biggest chunk of explaining the role of the microbiome. Happy to jump into the questions and get people engaged a little bit.
That is awesome. So let me just grab some questions here. And Siobhan, we're not hearing you. So let me know if you're hearing us in one way or another. Could you please send me a message via any of our channels, and I'll be on the lookout for that. So first question up here is from our lovely Sonia. How can we strengthen our immune system even though we're still battling dysbiosis?
Yeah. So, I mean, you know, obviously the common micronutrients will help the immune system, doing things like increasing your doses and intake of vitamin C, increasing your intake of vitamin D, zinc, K2, all of those things, magnesium, all of those things play a really important role in the function of your immune system. But as you're battling dysbiosis, the thing is you can make daily improvements in dysbiosis, right? You might have a degree of dysbiosis that creates a gut issue. Like, for example, let's say you're dealing with SIBO. Clearly, you have dysbiosis if you have SIBO. Now, can you still make improvements in your microbiome that impact your immune system, even though the SIBO is still there? Then yes, absolutely. Because one of the things one of the ways that the microbiome really improves immune response is by increasing diversity within the microbiome. So one of the simple things you can do is get outside more, get out in nature more. Because when you're in nature, if you go for things like hikes, if you go for walking on trails, if you're in the outside environment, you will pick up more microbes from the outside environment. And picking up those kind of microbes will actually kind of help and stimulate your immune response. And so that is part of one of the things you can do. You can also, if you have pets, you can spend a little bit more intimate time with the pets, because just picking up the microbes from the pets themselves will help enhance your immune response. Taking things like probiotics, you know, we work a lot with the spore-based probiotics. We show that the spore-based probiotics have a great ability to expand the diversity within your microbiome. They also are immunogenic in that they do kind of support immune response pretty effectively. Using things like prebiotics if you can, diversifying some of your dietary choices, all of those things will help kind of boost up your immune response. And then of course, you cannot overestimate the importance of sleep, because one of the things that occurs when you sleep is you get kind of an increase in diversity in your microbiome. You get different types of strains within your microbiome proliferating at that time. And many of those can be very stimulatory and beneficial to your immune system. And then one more thing is managing stress. Stress is a major driver of leaky gut. Stress is a major driver of chronic inflammation. And if you can do things to try to manage stress, you know, whether it's mindfulness work, whether it's finding an outlet, drawing, singing, going out for runs, whatever it may be that you can do to distract yourself, or even just binge watching TV shows. If it brings down the cortisol, the epinephrine, norepinephrine levels, that's good, because those things will help reduce the proliferation of pathogenic organisms. It'll reduce intestinal permeability, and it'll reduce that inflammation that's going on in the body that really compromises your immune response.
Thank you. That's great. As usual, practical tips, and then, of course, the science of it all. So from Mary Ann, I am wondering if I have a large nasal Staphylococci aureus bacteria from a nasal culture lab, how might that impact my immune system and my tolerance of Megaspore biotic in the gut?
Yeah. Did she say nasal? Nasal Staph aureus?
Yes, please.
Yeah, okay. It shouldn't affect your tolerance of Megaspore at all in the gut. But nasal colonization of Staph aureus is one of the key factors in chronic sinusitis, rhinosinusitis. So that organism can create inflammatory response in your nasal mucosa and your sinus mucosa. And that's one of the characteristics of people that tend to have chronic rhinosinusitis. So you have to be a little bit more diligent about working to improve your gut health, because the gut immune response is going to play a role in trying to control those microbes in the sinuses, because the mucosal system I talked about, the central command center for the mucosal system in the body is in the gut. And when the gut mucosa is healthy and functioning properly, because you've got a healthy gut, it will have an impact on what's happening in your sinuses and your nasal area as well. So you'll have a better opportunity to try to control some of the overgrowth through your immune response if your gut is healthier. So it shouldn't impact your tolerance and so on. For other reasons, you may need to taper up and go slower, but ultimately having a healthy gut will improve what goes on in the nasal and sinus cavities.
Okay, and from Donna Marie, on my son's GI MAP test, it showed low secretory IgA at 274 micrograms per grams and H. pylori as NA, not applicable. They say that they detected quote-unquote, some H. pylori, but not enough to mark it positive. But I didn't want to mark it negative either. But they didn't want to mark it negative either. Should I still treat it with results like this? And if so, what's the best course of treatment? He already takes Megaspore and Mega IgG and S. boulardii.
Yeah, so you know, we really can't give you treatment recommendations. We're not really set up to do that on this kind of platform. I can give you a couple things to think about to talk to your healthcare practitioner about. One thing they think you know, keep in mind is it's very hard to detect the accurate levels of H. pylori in a stool test, because the stool test is the source of the material, which is stool, is coming out like 20 something feet away from where H. pylori lives, right? So picking up any amount of H. pylori to me in the stool indicates that it's probably there pretty prevalently, because you're picking it up so far away from where H. pylori lives. So I would say that that's probably something you should address. And there's other ways of more accurate ways of diagnosing an H. pylori infection that you could work with a gastroenterologist with. To understand if that is an issue. If it is an issue, there's a number of solutions that they can do. They'll prescribe things for you. If you want to do things on your own, you can look at taking some supplemental HCl. One of the things that H. pylori does is it lowers the amount of acid that's being produced in the stomach. It prefers a slightly higher pH, and it tends to increase the pH in the stomach to be able to proliferate some. So bringing down the stomach pH might help control it to a certain degree. We work with a licorice extract that has some clinical studies on it showing supporting a healthier balance of H. pylori within the stomach. So that's a natural product you can look at as well. But again, you know, talk to your healthcare practitioner, because it's really important to understand the overall picture and everything that's going on. But if you're concerned about H. pylori and you think that it might be an issue, There are other diagnostics that you can use. A stool test is not the best diagnostic for it.
Okay, and since Siobhan isn't here yet, I'm sure we'll have her back soon. I do want to echo what she and Kiran just said right now, which is that you do need to take this to your practitioner and get some advice on very specific issues like this. So on to Carlene. I take Megaspore HU58 and Mega IgG 2000 every day. Is the Mega IgG 2000 helpful to be taken during the COVID pandemic?
You know, I take the Mega IgG every day. There's enough data on it from other clinical trials that show that it does support a much healthier immune response. I believe the company we work with that produces the immunoglobulins, they are doing a COVID study right now, but I don't know what those results are, so we can't infer what the benefits may be. But you know, it is something that helps your immune system. So anything that supports your immune system, that provides a little bit more resilience is going to be important. So for me personally, I'm taking all the things in my toolbox to support immune response, because obviously not only do we have COVID that we're concerned about and dealing with, but as the fall moves forward, we've got the flu and rotavirus and norovirus and all of this stuff that starts circulating around at higher frequency. And, I want to remain resilient throughout the time. So I'm doing a number of things, a lot of things we just talked about as well, the fasting, the resting, the mindfulness work, of course, taking all the micronutrients, but I'm definitely hammering in high doses of probiotics. Prebiotics, oligosaccharides play a big role in immune response, in the energetics of immune response, because one of the critical things that your immune system needs in order to even respond is fuel. And the fuel that the immune system uses typically comes from the short chain fatty acids that are produced in your gut, right? So when the way you make short chain fatty acids in the gut is through taking in resistant starches, you know, certain types of fibers, and then more potently, specific prebiotics, especially oligosaccharides. So I'm taking my prebiotics, probiotics, immunoglobulins, fish oil, the higher EPA fish oil, because we're going to keep inflammatory response down, especially in the gut. Those are some of the things I'm taking quite religiously to maintain resilience.
Okay, and on to, we're going to change tack a little bit and look into some treatment questions, if that's okay.
Yeah.
From Roberta, I have been doing some research on SIBO. I have listened to some doctors saying, are we treating SIBO correctly? They are saying it is more about small intestinal dysbiosis than actual overgrowth. And to kill everything leaves us in a worse condition. I would love to hear your thoughts on this. This might be why so many never get long-term relief, even though they are doing extreme protocols.
Yeah. I've done webinars on SIBO SOS, and I've been speaking on SIBO for at least the last year and a half at conferences. I do think we're approaching SIBO completely differently, completely wrongly. And I think we need to approach it differently. You know, SIBO in itself, to me, is a symptom of a bigger problem, the overgrowth part of it, which is the part that everyone focuses on because it creates the bloating, the distension, and all the discomfort, right? The overgrowth is a symptom of other systems not functioning well. Some of those other systems are a poor oral health. So oral microbiome becomes a big source of dysbiotic SIBO bacteria, right? So those bacteria are growing constantly in the mouth. You're swallowing gallons of spit a day, and you're taking in billions and billions of these microbes into your small intestine every single day. Now, one of the reasons why it's allowed to survive through the small intestine, through the stomach, as you're swallowing it, is because HCL production is compromised. And that can be compromised by a number of reasons. Number one, it could be just poor nutritional status. Number two, it could be H. pylori overgrowth, which is a more common thing than we think. Use of things like antacids, proton pump inhibitors. And in fact, there is a whole category of SIBO called PPI-induced SIBO. Because studies show clearly when you compromise stomach acid, you get SIBO. Why is that? Well, because the stomach acid is not killing these microbes that you swallow all day long that aren't supposed to be in the small intestine. So the small intestinal dysbiosis in SIBO is pretty clear. What tends to happen is you get something called a taxa shift, where you go from a certain type of normal gram-positive bacteria that predominates the small intestine to a gram-negative shift, where you have a lot of gram-negative bacteria that are producing things like gases and so on that are fermenting in a way that they're not supposed to be, that fermenting shouldn't be occurring within the small intestine. And then they're also driving permeability. They drive inflammation in the small intestinal mucosa, which opens up the tight junctions. Now, when they drive permeability, they're driving inflammation. That inflammation causes more dysbiosis, more dysfunction. The other aspect of SIBO that seems to be very clear is liver dysfunction, because bile is really important in preventing overgrowth in the small intestine, right? The small intestine is a great place for bacteria to grow. It's warm, it's moist, there's constantly food and liquid coming through. But with our natural protective mechanism to prevent bacteria from overgrowing the small intestine is this bile flow that continues to flow through every time you eat food. Bile is a very strong antimicrobial itself, so it itself will bring down microbial growth. But then the other thing that bile does is it also conjugates with fat from the diet and creates a saponification reaction, which kills bacteria. And then it also triggers receptors called the FXR nuclear receptors in your intestinal lining, which causes your intestinal lining to release antimicrobials to bring down the growth of bacteria in the small intestine. So we've got all of these protective mechanisms in place to prevent bacteria from overgrowing beyond a certain level in the small intestine when food is present, right? And so often what you see, and there's a bunch of studies on the connection between liver dysfunction and SIBO, the connection between proton pump inhibitor use and H. pylori infection and SIBO. So when you see that the stomach is compromised, HCL production is compromised, and then the liver is compromised, then the two most important protective mechanisms to prevent dysbiotic bacteria from getting in there and prevent them from overgrowing, those two things are not working. And so you get this condition where you can have overgrowth of bacteria. Now, another part that is really profound is the stasis that you see in SIBO. You'll hear a lot of doctors and researchers who work on SIBO all the time talk about stasis, meaning the bowel is not moving, right? And when the bowel is not moving, then food and microbes are allowed to sit and putrefy in that region. In the small intestine, the bowel is supposed to be moving all the time. Food is supposed to be pushed through at a relatively rapid rate until it gets to the large intestine where it dumps in. Now, what tends to occur in people with SIBO is the bowel stop moving, both your peristaltic activity that scoots the food down and also the migrating mortar complex, which is that electrical wave that comes through and cleans out the intestines. Both of those things get compromised. One of the key drivers of that is leakiness in the gut. Endotoxins from the gut leak in, they make it up the vagus nerve, they enter into an area called the dorsal vagal complex. And when they sit in the dorsal vagal complex and create an inflammatory response, it shuts off the signal from the brain to the gut. So it stops that peristaltic activity. It causes that stasis, right? So now you've got these three compounding factors. You've got oral dysbiotic microbes that are going in. The compromised stomach acid is not killing them off, so they're allowed to survive through to a certain degree. They're now entering the small intestine and causing the dysbiosis. So they're fighting off the small intestinal, the normal small intestinal bacteria. And so they're starting to establish the dysbiotic population. At the same time, your liver is compromised because of endotoxemia and other things. So now your bile flow is compromised and restricted. So you're not getting enough of that antimicrobial, natural antimicrobial functionality and that microbial control. And then as more of these gram-negative bacteria come in, they'll start opening up the tight junctions. Their endotoxins leak through, causing the stoppage of the gut, of the brain to gut signaling, and then you start getting stasis in the bowels. So now what you have is a compromised stomach, a stasis in the bowel, and a compromised liver. And so all of those three things in most SIBO treatments are not being addressed. We're just going after the overgrowth all the time. But all of the mechanisms that are now dysfunctional that are allowing the overgrowth still exist. Hence, the overgrowth just keeps coming back. So, you know, I do like a 90-minute webinar on this. And so, you know, there's many things to look at in my view in SIBO. It's important to look at oral care. It's important to look at what's happening in the stomach and HCL production and how H. pylori plays a role. It's important to look at liver health and what's happening with your bile flow and your gallbladder. You know, it's important to look at leakiness in the gut and peristalsis and all of those things. So it's far more complex than just some bacteria making their way down there and overgrowing. And then the idea of just killing them down and then everything will be fine. It obviously it's not proving out to work.
Certainly lots of things going on there for sure. And just so everybody knows, we do actually have a Facebook unit that has all of Kiran's SIBO SOS materials in the Facebook group. So in the Facebook group, you look over the left side of the group and you should find the units in there. One of them is Kiran's, and you'll find that easy. So we'll move on to Connie. Hi, Connie. Thanks for the lovely testimonial, by the way. She's got two questions, which are super connected. We'll just start with one. When stool test shows no short chain fatty acid levels, it's supposed to be related to leaky gut. Can you please mention treatments or supplements or food sources to rebuild SCFA, short chain fatty acids? How do we increase butyrate, acetate, and valerate?
Yeah, so the easiest way is take your spore-based probiotics, the prebiotic that we have, because we've published a study. We published it in August of last year showing that when you take the Megaspore probiotic with the prebiotic, that in as little as 3 weeks, you increase short-chain fatty acid production by almost 150%. That includes butyrate, propionate, acetate, valerate, all of them. So it's really critical that you use the probiotic and prebiotic combination. So that is one of the easiest ways. The other way you can, the other things you can add on to it. So I would say that's the predominant way because it's the easiest and most potent way to do it. The other things you can add on is trying to increase a little bit of fasting if you do any fasting at all. Believe it or not, that actually increases some of the short-chain fatty acid-producing bacteria. And then another third thing would be increasing dietary intake of things like resistant starches. So prebiotics, resistant starches in the diet will help as well. But the spores become really important because they enhance the growth of the microbes that specifically turn resistant starches and oligosaccharides into short-chain fatty acids. So taking the spores is critical. And in fact, you know, that's what I have here right now. It's a mix of the prebiotic that we have, the Mega Pre. And of course I take my spores with my lunch as well.
Okay, so part two of that question, just to follow up, is does having an excess of Citrobacter, Farmeri, Frundi, and Klebsiella oxytoca pneumoniae in a stool test contribute or is linked to SIBO? What can we do to lower those strains in the colon?
So having them in the colon is not necessarily related to SIBO. Now, the first question I would ask is what stool tests are you looking at? Because the accuracy of the data is really important. But let's say you do have overgrowth in those organisms. Then one of the best things to do is try to crowd them out with enhancing the growth of beneficial organisms. It's really hard to take any sort of antimicrobial to specifically go down there and specifically kill off those microbes. It just doesn't exist. So the best way is just to crowd them out by promoting the growth of good beneficial bacteria. The best ways to do that is, you know, using prebiotics, using the spore-based probiotics, increasing the diversity of your diet, and so on. So to me, that's always the better way to try to control microbes.
Oh, I think we...
Hey, guess what?
There you go!
Are you back?
Hi, Siobhan!
There, I am back. I was not gone. I heard everything, and I was typing in notes to the Facebook group, but there was a little Zoom fun technicality, and who knows? But I'm here. Clarissa, you are a rock star, girl. Thank you. You did such a good job, didn't she, Kiran?
She did. I know. It was awesome. It's like she does this every day.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, thank you, but Clarissa. I'll give back the mic, Siobhan. You gave me a run for my money there.
Yeah, you did great. Thank you so much. Clarissa, just for reference, is one of our incredible behind-the-scenes team members who does so much for this community that they will never know about, but everyone on the inner circle of running the community is forever grateful to Clarissa. So I'm actually glad that you guys got a chance to at least hear her voice. Clarissa, I'm going to go to the GDoc, and if you want to mark on there where you, how far you got. But I want to take this moment, Karen, to ask you the question that I sent you in advance about the stool test. I know that you have a new stool test. We were the first people to actually launch it on social media. Thank you for that honor. Tell us the name of it. Tell us what it does. Tell us what it doesn't do. And the big, you know, Matthew Pope, one of our members, also had that question about the raw data. So if you could take that on for us, I'd really appreciate it.
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, stool testing can be an important component of really understanding what's going on with your body, right? It it can provide a clue. It's not an absolute diagnostic either way, good or bad, but it does provide clues, especially when you align the clues with symptomology and history and so on. So it can be useful. Now, it has to be very accurate in order for it to be useful, because imagine you're taking this sample that has, you know, thousands and thousands and thousands of cells of bacteria. And in fact, if we're talking about cells, we're talking about millions and millions of cells of bacteria. And then you're trying to like sequence it and figure out who all is there and in what proportion, you know, and it's that's not easy work to do. Now, one of the problems I've had with most stool tests that are available in the marketplace is they're using technology that does not allow for highly accurate analysis of the population structure of the microbiome. Because one of the things that's important to note about the microbiome is it's an ecosystem. And the strength and the function of the ecosystem is based on what does the population dynamics look like, right? So it's not just the presence of a single bacteria, whether it's high or low. It's about the population dynamics. It's about relative abundance. That's a really important word when we're talking about microbiome analysis. So most of the stool tests available out there are just using technology that scientifically has been shown cannot give you that kind of accurate relative abundance species level data. So a lot of it that you're seeing on the reports is kind of guesswork, right? It's programs that make a guess at what's happening, but it can't really paint the picture of the ecosystem, you know? So that's really a difficult thing. It's not giving you the most accurate data. So we wanted to see, okay, is there a way we can do stool testing and increase the accuracy, increasing the benefit and utility of the stool test? So sure enough, the next generation of technology to sequence information is using something called whole genome sequencing. Whole genome sequencing is a far more accurate way of doing it. You're getting a full HD kind of picture, and you get much more accurate results on looking at population dynamics, looking at relative abundance of all of the different players within the microbiome, right? So that will give you a much better understanding of what's actually happening in your gut ecosystem. And then also that allows us to tease out data on functionality. Like we can look at functional groups of microbes who conduct certain activities and look at their relative abundance to other microbes and tell you, do you have the right amount of those functional groups when you look at a population of healthy, normal individuals, right? So it gives you clues as to what may be going wrong in your system. So it's a whole other way. It's the next generation of the way that you do sequencing. It's very accurate, it's high definition, and it provides you a lot more useful, actionable information. Because ultimately, all of this is about seeking out healing opportunities, right? Many people out there have very complex cases. They have complex histories. You've been working with numerous health practitioners. You might be working with one now, or you may not be. And so you're trying to find all of this information that can help you figure out the right path to make yourself better. We wanted, and a lot of people use microbiome testing for that. We wanted to be able to give you a way of doing it in the most accurate way that'll give you the most useful information. So that's the importance of the importance of the biome effects stool test. It's the first stool test that focuses on functionality within the microbiome and gives you real clear population dynamics, so you can align your symptomology and your responses to things with what it shows as functions and dysfunctions within your microbiome. Now, to address the question of raw data, You know, one of the questions that, was asked that Siobhan had sent over to me is, you know, why doesn't the company give people their raw data? Well, because it's like, we don't even have the raw data, because there's no sense you can make out of the raw data. If you remember, DNA is made up of four nucleotides, right? A, T, G, and C. And DNA sequences are random combinations of A, T, G, and C. When we do sequencing and whole genome sequencing, the raw data you get back is 3 million reads of A, T, Gs, and Cs, right? So the raw data would be 500 pages of just lines going A, T, G, C, G, C, T, G, A, something, you know, some random codes like that. It makes absolutely no sense to anybody. The only way it makes sense is once you put it into something called a bioinformatics pipeline, where you've got all of this computing technology that knows how to read and assemble all of that genomic information to understand what genes there are, which microbes there are, and so on. So all of that raw sequencing data goes into a computational system that assembles all of the information, goes through all its algorithms and AI systems and all that, and spits out your results at the end, which is what you get, right? So the raw data is meaningless to, it's meaningless to us, it's meaningless to you. We're not gonna be emailing you 500 page PDF with just random ATs, Gs, and Cs. So that's, you know.
Kieran, I just wanted to say, you know, I think if Matthew, if you're listening to this, which hopefully you will, you know, send me an email at info@cibosos.com so we can take the conversation directly to Kieran and get you some answers. But if this doesn't, you know, answer all your questions. But I think people are used to getting their 23andMe raw data and then going to some of the Facebook groups and some of the cool sites. And they have algorithms and software there that will translate people's like SNPs and that kind of thing. And I think that's what we're looking for. Do you think that might be the next chapter of microbiome stool testing?
No, because so with 23andMe, all of these companies have built out technologies on reading human genomic data, right? And that's part of the service that 23andMe never really did that well. And so now the bioinformatics pipeline I'm talking about, where the raw data goes in and gets read and comes out, is what the labs like Cosmos ID decide what service they provide. When it comes to human genomics, the initial labs like 23andMe did not provide that. So we do not have these third-party bioinformatics companies that can take the raw data and then read it through in a particular way to give you any relevant information. Because remember, with your human genome, all you're looking for is SNPs, right? So you're looking at single nucleotides that create potential mutations. When you have these SNPs, when you have single nucleotides that create potential mutations, they're just reading the human genome, and then they find a SNP in a common gene, and then they can report that SNP, like you have this SNP, right? Or you have that SNP. So it's reporting just a series of SNPs. When we're talking about the microbiome, we're talking about assembling an entire ecosystem. And that is done only by certain specialized companies right now. Maybe in the next 5 years, there'll be companies that pop up and all they do is they assemble the genomic raw data from the microbiome samples. And then you can take your raw data and send it to them if you wish. But that doesn't exist right now.
Okay, that makes sense. I think there were a couple of tests that they were kind of comparing it to. One was Thrive and one was BiomeSite. Are you familiar with those, Kieran?
I think I'm familiar with Thrive. I don't know about BiomeSite now.
I think what would be really helpful, Jackie's with us, Matthew's with us. It was kind of them on the thread, just as we're getting super granular. I'd love to get something from you guys, Jackie and Matthew, just like, hey, this is what we loved about these tests and what we would love to see, you know, if Kieran can incorporate this into a test interpretation. Because, you know, Kieran's open to suggestions, so we'll get you some feedback there for you, Kieran, on the test.
Sure,
move us all forward. Thank you for addressing that. Okay, so I've got a couple other questions for you. And I think what I'm going to do is send this out to the Facebook group and my mailing list as basically a podcast. since I had the little technical difficulties there. And I know that it's also showing my name a lot on the screen. That's because my mic is activating and I'm on the side of a highway right now, just trying to make things happen. Didn't want to cancel, didn't want to do anything different. So I'm just making the magic happen, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Okay.
Yeah, that's what we got to do. That is what we have to do. By the way, they're really liking your pace today, Karen. Very relaxed. You always are so good at getting all the information out so quickly. And they're like, yes, he slowed down a little bit. I can really get what he's saying. So good on you. What do you think about fiber powders? Many SIBO protocols suggest you wait until the SIBO is cleared to add fiber powders if needed in the diet. Would you speak to this concept and whether powders are less fermentable like guar gum? But Nora, remember, it's partially hydrolyzed guar gum that the studies were done on for SIBO patients having increased efficacy with Xifaxan. What do you think about partially hydrolyzed guar gum? And does it make any difference if it's hydrogen SIBO or IMO?
Yeah, there doesn't seem to be hard and fast rules on what's going to be tolerated by people and not, right? So I think fiber is really important for people with SIBO because you're cutting out so much of your sources of fiber from your diet. And ultimately that's going to cause a bigger issue down the road with your health than the SIBO itself. And so I think it's really important to try to find fibers that you can tolerate and take in. And I think it's going to be a trial and error game. You know, our mega prebiotic, which is highly complex oligosaccharides, those things will actually go down further in your large intestine. And we find that a lot of our SIBO clients deal with that much better. And they can take smaller doses of it. In many cases, they're effective in doses at 300-400 milligrams, which is a pretty relatively low dose. And but in some cases, people don't tolerate it, you know? So I think you just have to try. It's really hard to say because not only what's overgrown, I don't think there's hard and fast rules of what type of SIBO you have. It's a collection of dysbiotic bacteria in there. And so it really depends on what your collection looks like.
100%. I've got two questions. I actually have a bunch. So we only have 14 minutes left. So I'm going to go quick. I'm going to go quickly now. About Atron Teal from Juliana. I know you're great colleagues with Dr. Ken Brown, triple board certified gastroenterologist who created Atron Teal, the only clinically shown supplement to reduce bloating. We're big fans here. It says basically when the makers of Atron Teal, that you shouldn't take a probiotic at the same time. What do you think about that? I know that Dr. Brown is a huge fan of Megaspore and you're a huge fan of Atron Teal, but what do you think about that?
Yeah, I think he would say different about the spores, understanding the functionality of the spores. I think for the most part, what they're referring to is the conventional, high dose lactobifido probiotics that people tend to take. I think I've had many conversations with him, and I think the spores would be a different recommendation for.
From Kay, she has a daughter who is disabled with seizures. I know this isn't medical advice. She is worried she's giving her too many probiotics. If I give her Saccharomyces boulardii 5 billion viable cells, that's the one capsule, and bifidobacterium bifidum 1.5 billion organisms a day, she's disabled with seizures and has had SIBO. I feel the SIBO is much improved, but she has weirdly frothy saliva. It might not be related, but I was just wondering if I'm overdoing those probiotics and there was no sign of thrush in her mouth.
Yeah, I mean, that's hard to say. I can't see that kind of response of bifidobacterium bifidum and so on. I don't think that of a way it would be connected, but it's hard to say.
Okay. Well, my heart goes out to you. Bless you and your daughter and your whole family. I know that I don't know. I can't even imagine. But, you know, that'd be interesting to see if you could get a stool test for her, just in here brainstorming, because the mouth is the other end, you know, it's the top of the digestive system. So something's going on for sure. Be sure to look at our speaker list if you're looking for someone who can help, who's a doctor who I think might be able to get to the root of that. Okay. Any thoughts on belching? Do you have any suggestions for upper GI gas belching, even when SIBO tests are negative?
Yeah, I mean, I think a lot of that can be due just to the pressure that's created in the large bowel, in the small bowel, sorry, and maybe even gastric pressure. In some cases, it may be slowing down of your gastric emptying. And so you're building up gas in the stomach itself. And so one of the things that we use for that is a MegaGuard, which helps with support that healthy gastric emptying, you know, the time of it. So that's one of the things we use. It's got an artichoke extract in it that has studies on gastric emptying. And of course, it's got a ginger, which actually helps move the bowel as well. So I would look at that. That can be driven by this issue of gastric emptying.
From Ramona, how about if someone has Lyme and co-infections and EBV that's not active right now? Does that mean the immune system is still trying to deal with it and is overwhelmed?
So those kind of things, like especially EBV and other what we call latent infections, the immune system's not constantly battling those, right? Because one of the things that a virus like EBV does well is it stays hidden for a period of time so it doesn't trigger the immune response. However, the moment your immune system is somewhat compromised, whether it's through stress, lack of sleep, poor nutrition, whatever it may be, then those viruses and all that have a mechanism of reading that, and they will start proliferating. And then if they start proliferating, it will compromise your immune system even further, right? So those are opportunistic pathogens. They're really good at reading the state of the host, especially when it comes to stress. And then the moment your stress is increased, then they will start proliferating higher up. So having those latent infections, the key is going to be to maintain kind of a higher baseline activity of your immune response. So taking things like your vitamin C's, D's, and so on to keep your immune system functioning properly, lubed up properly, if you will, taking the right probiotics so you're always getting this kind of stimulatory effect on your immune system. And then, of course, watching out the things that suppress your immune system, things like stress, especially. And lack of rest. So if you can keep those things at bay, it shouldn't be too much of an issue.
Okay, hang on. Let's see. Okay. Any thoughts on antivinculin levels? It's so specific to post-infectious IBS and SIBO, but I didn't know if you were, you know, had any thoughts on that.
No, I mean, that's more of a strict clinical diagnosis, and it has many interpretations depending on the history of the person and what they're particularly dealing with. So there's no hard and fast rules about it that I could speak to.
Okay. We've got a couple of questions about megamucosa. Mm-hmm. Do you take megamucosa at the same time as Megaspore or separately throughout the day?
It doesn't matter. You could do either one. Yeah, I drink my Mega Mucosa. So in my drink right now, you can see I have a mix of my Mega Mucosa and Mega Pre. And that's mixed up together. And then, of course, which I made for lunch. And then I, of course, took my Megaspore with lunch, which was my first meal of the day. But if you did the Megaspore in the evening, you did these earlier, it doesn't really matter as long as you're getting it in at some point during the day.
And do you ever... Anna's also getting a little bit mucousy after drinking Mega Mucosa. Is that normal? Should she titrate down?
We have not heard of that response. But yeah, you could very well titrate down and see if that changes it. I know we have thousands of people that use it. But I've not heard that response before. But to test it, yeah, I think titrating down a little bit would give you a clue if that has an effect.
Okay, and then let's see. Okay, from Cindy, I am both hydrogen and methane positive for SIBO, diagnosed 3 weeks ago. I'm about to go on GI Synergy tomorrow. Do you think that's the best to start with? Is GI Synergy Microbiome Labs?
No, I don't know what that is. No.
Okay. We're gonna move on. Okay. Okay, Cindy wants to know how to order Megaspore and Megapre. Go to the website. It's microbiomelabs.com, right, Karen?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Microbiomelabs.com.
Okay. Yep, and if you use the patient direct code SIBOSOS, that first order, you're going to get 15% off, thanks to Karen's generosity. So thanks for that. But you can go to the website there and check out all the products. Plus, there's a whole resource, you know, of information on the website as well. And we're working on building ours out too. But in the meanwhile, go to, you know, the source there. Okay. Anita, you're asking about a product that our dear friend Rachel Fresco makes, which is biobotanicals. So check out biobotanicals.com to answer your question. And Cindy's in the Bahamas working with a nutritionist in California. You got to find out that root cause. We have a class on how to find your underlying conditions at SIBOSOS.com under resources. Okay. Ask that question in the group, Cindy. I think you're going to get more support in the group. Let me just quickly go through here. Okay. And we have 6 minutes left. I'm going to go to the Facebook page and see if anything else came in. Thanks, you guys. What I'm going to do is post this, just the audio recording. So if you don't see it, to go back and listen to it right away, know that we'll get it on there as soon as possible. And Karen, any parting thoughts? What should we be thinking about in your perspective of traveling the world virtually these days and hearing what the other, you know, science thought leaders are thinking about in terms of back to the idea of immunity in our microbiome and just any other random things that you've been surprised about lately?
Mm-hmm. You know, I think a really important message that people need to hear is that your immune system is amazing. Right. I know when something like COVID first came on, there was all of this talk of we have no immunity against it. And so it's a very scary pathogen. And yes, it can do some awful things. But our immune system is very well equipped to deal with things like this. Right. We've evolved to a point where we can defend our bodies in amazingly dramatic ways and against all kinds of pathogens. And so something like a COVID shouldn't be a problem for the vast majority of people, assuming you've got basic health status. So it's important not to panic. It's important not to be afraid. It's important to be cautious. Those are all things that should be practiced. But know that you have a lot within your power to be able to control your system, to control how your system responds, to build your resilience so that you can face this potentially dangerous world out there and be perfectly fine, right? So, we know clearly that chronic inflammation, that gut dysfunction, all of that stuff will drive immune dysfunction, make you more susceptible, less resilient, and so on. Less resilient and so on. So it becomes really important to understand that you have a lot of power within you to do things. Your diet, your lifestyle, your exercise, the supplements you take, all of those things will have a huge impact on how resilient and awesomely profound your system works. And all of that is within your control. And you can do that for yourself. You can do that for your family, your loved ones. So as we're going into the fall, it's going to be a scary time because we're going to keep hearing all kinds of news about the flu season and the flu is going to start ticking up and maybe COVID will start ticking up. You know, we don't know. Maybe something else will show up in the meantime. But all in all, know that your body is amazing. It works amazingly well. And you have a lot of power within yourself to really improve your outcome. So don't feel helpless. Don't feel scared. Be cautious, be prudent, be smart, pay attention to programs like this, and you'll be just fine.
Well, Karen, thank you so much, my friend. We appreciate you. I know we have some more talks booked with you before the end of the year. You're inspiring as always, informative as always, and you take care and be safe and carry on, sir. Thank you so much.
Thank you, guys. Thank you, everyone. We'll talk again.
Okay, thanks. Bye-bye. All right. So, okay, we will talk to you next time. We've got a big encore weekend coming up for the Gut and Microbiome Rescue Summit. So I hope you'll find that if you haven't. And lots more planned for you before the end of the year. So be sure to check back in the group frequently. And even if you're just watching and hanging out and reading everybody's posts and you have a burning question or need, please post that. We are here for you and we appreciate you. Okay, take care, everyone. Bye.